Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into the award-winning Public Affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to continue our focus on breast cancer here during October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. You know, breast cancer affects about 3,000 women in Connecticut every year and takes more than 500 of our loved ones from us. So we'll be chatting with a breast surgeon from St. Francis Hospital in Hartford and calling on any woman, especially if you're uninsured or underinsured, to come out to one of three locations on October 18th for a free mammogram screening. Then we'll turn to alternative medicine, paying a visit to Connecticut Family Acupuncture and speaking to its founder about how he is using this ancient healing art in the war against opioid addiction and how acupuncture is growing in popularity and acceptance among his mainstream peers as a go-to therapy to help treat a number of other health conditions. And we'll close checking in with the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station and Dr. Kirby Stafford, who was recently called to South Norwalk, where he discovered the state's first reproducing population of Lone Star ticks, which have already outpaced the population of black-legged or deer ticks on eastern Long Island. Stick around to find out what you should know about this looming new public health threat. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. If you're worried about or seeking information on future long-term care costs, you're going to want to attend an upcoming public forum entitled The Missing Link in Retirement Planning, Why and When to Consider Long-Term Care Insurance. This forum is coming up on October 24th at the Wallingford Public Library on North Main Street, beginning promptly at 6 p.m. The state of Connecticut, in conjunction with the Wallingford Public Library, is presenting this free two-hour session that's open to the public. No insurance sales are going to take place at this event, but you will come away better prepared to consider investing in a long-term care plan. To register for the program, call 800-547-3443 or just hit the public forum link at ctpartnership.org. Well, it's been a while since we checked in with our friends at St. Francis, and it seems appropriate here during October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, that we lead off another one of our segments on the award-winning For the People. I should say another one of our programs talking about the issue a little bit more in depth than we kind of got into last week with the great folks and volunteers from Making Strides. I'm pleased to make the acquaintance of Dr. Christine Risk. She's a surgeon and medical director for the Comprehensive Women's Health Center at St. Francis in Hartford. Christine, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having us, John. We really appreciate your opportunity to discuss breast cancer and how women can protect themselves from this disease.
And having covered this subject as we sort of chatted about for a few minutes before we turned on the microphone, what I consistently hear year after year, doctor after doctor, cause representative after cause representative, is that the people who are at most risk are the ones who don't have access to screening. So it's so awesome that you and your organization is sponsoring Pink Link, which is free screening mammograms for the underinsured and uninsured women of Connecticut, which is happening for a 12-hour period from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, October 18th. And we're going to talk a lot more about that. But it's being offered at three convenient locations, spa-like settings for your guests and patients while they wait. It'll be happening at the Radiology Associates of Hartford in Glastonbury on Sycamore Street, the Comprehensive Women's Health Center at St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center in Hartford, and at the Johnson Surgery Center and Radiology Department in Enfield. So we'll come back and talk a little bit more with Dr. Risk about that. But Dr. Risk, let's start off with the basics. Right now, as much as we hear great news about research and prevention and education and how so many more people, even this year than last year, are getting the message, hearing the warnings, and taking a necessary necessary preventative steps and being the beneficiaries of spectacular research and expertise like you offer to your patients, we're still looking at a situation where 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime.
That's absolutely right, John. It's a disease that affects everyone. Everyone knows someone either in their family, their friends, their work life, and it's so important that people understand. You know, one of the most common things I get asked once a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer is almost a bewilderment. How did this happen? I don't even have a family history. I don't feel unwell. I don't even feel anything in my breast. And those are all important points that underscore the tremendous need for mammogram, because it is, in fact, very true. 4 out of 5 women do not have a family history of breast cancer. So that means the overwhelming majority of women with breast cancer, it does not run in their family. And that's always really surprising to women at the time of diagnosis. And the other thing that I'd like to underscore is that thanks to mammogram, you know, breast cancer, thankfully, you know, is very curable if caught early, which is the exact purpose of the mammogram. And oftentimes it's pretty stealth. It doesn't necessarily present with a lump. It doesn't necessarily present with an outward abnormality of the breast. Certainly it can, and we as trained providers look for those changes. We educate women on those changes. But the fact of the matter is a woman can have a perfectly normal breast exam and definitely still have breast cancer. And the only way we can detect it and do something about it and impact survival is with mammograms. So, you know, there are very few things in medicine that we can all agree on. But the one thing we can agree on is that mammograms definitely save lives. And that's really, really important to underscore. And I would also, if I may, I often hear from women, you know, I just don't have time to get a mammogram. And the fact of the matter is it's a once-a-year test. You can be in and out, really depending on where you go, particularly at our facility. We're very, very attuned to getting women in and out in about, you know, an hour or so, soup to nuts or less. Sometimes it's even faster than that. The reason I mention an hour is if a woman, for example, needs an ultrasound to go with it. But at our facility, we not only get women in and out very quickly, but we also give same-day results, which is really important for that peace of mind. That, you know, I, as a woman who's, you know, well over 40, who needs to get a mammogram every year, you know, it's nice to walk in and to be able to walk out very quickly with an answer. And it's you know, I've heard everything from I don't have time to they're very painful. And I think it's really important to dispel those myths because, you know, first off, I always say to women, you have to make time for yourself. Women, we're very good at taking care of the universe and everyone in our universe except ourselves. And so to take an hour from work or an hour from your life once a year, I think as women, we owe it to ourselves.
Sure.
We owe it to ourselves. And it's single-handedly the most important test a woman can get to screen for one of the most common malignancies in women that we otherwise wouldn't know is there.
Yeah, and those who
and
are...
the last point, I...
Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm, sorry, John.
No, I was going to say, those who are watching the clock, it's up to an hour. And when it does reach up to that hour or beyond that 1 hour point, as you kind of briefly pointed out, it is because, I guess, or if I understand correctly, because the woman has been marked to have dense breast tissue, which then requires an ultrasound. And thankfully, here in the state of Connecticut, by law, is sort of mandated to be able to have that ultrasound covered by insurance.
That's exactly right, John. So if a woman needs an ultrasound, or even if she doesn't, but say, for example, they see something that they want to get magnified pictures or pictures from different views, that's when it can, you know, potentially take a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. But you know, quite frankly, we can do mammograms and get folks in and out extremely quickly. Mm. I haven't looked at data and numbers per se, but I can tell you just being there every day, day in and day out, I mean, within, 30 minutes or so, most women are walking out the door unless there's, as you pointed out, a need for an ultrasound, which I'd like to talk a little bit about, or the need for additional pictures. On your point of ultrasound, you're exactly right. If a woman is very dense, and oftentimes women will say, well, how do I even know that? And if you look carefully at the letter that a woman gets after a mammogram, which by law, every woman must get a letter that says that it was either fine or that you need to come back for more pictures, perhaps, depending on where you went for your imaging. It will also say what category of density a woman is, and that's either A, B, C, or D. And for the women that fall in the C and D categories, they are the ones that should be offered ultrasound because mammogram, like any test, nothing is perfect. Mm. And sometimes mammogram isn't able to pick up abnormalities as well in women who are very dense. And density really, it looks like, a concrete wall or a cloud in the sky, just a big white marshmallow-like area on a mammogram. I often describe it as it's like trying to find a snowflake in a snowstorm at that point if a woman does have mammographically dense breast.
Right. So it does provides that extra measure of imaging that is really required for the C and D classifications of tissue.
Yes, exactly. To help us see through that density, to help us see past it and through it. I often describe, breast density like looking at the sky at night. Mm. Is it a clear night? You'll see the moon and the stars. Is it a cloudy night? You won't see anything because you can't see past those clouds.
Right, yeah.
In a dense breast, we can't see past the density.
Yeah, the ultrasound cuts through the clouds, basically, and gives you a much better picture.
Exactly.
Well, if we're about halfway through our chat with Dr. Christine Risk. She's medical director for the Comprehensive Women's Health Center at St. Francis in Hartford, one of three locations for Pink Link coming up on Wednesday, October 18th, free screening mammograms for the underinsured and uninsured women at Radiology Associates of Hartford, at her office at the Comprehensive Women's Health Center, and at Johnson Surgery Center's Radiology Department in Enfield, and I should say Radiology Associates of Hartford. They're doing those scans at their Sycamore Street location in Glastonbury. We'll tell you a little bit more about that before we wrap up our chat with Dr. Risk in just a few minutes. Doctor, I was going to say I wanted to hit people here during Breast Cancer Awareness Month with a kind of a formula of threes. It's fortunate that breast cancer mortality has dropped by about 30% in the last 30 years. But here in Connecticut, roughly 3,000 women annually are diagnosed with breast cancer. And sadly, 550 or so women lose the battle each year right here in Connecticut from breast cancer. So I think if we talk about anything else for the rest of our conversation, we should absolutely key in on understanding the risks. Above and beyond genetic predisposition?
Well, certainly. So, a lot of times, we'll have women come in and we'll ask a series of questions that are known risk factors. And it's important to keep in mind that some women have, no risk factors and still get breast cancer. So I often will describe breast cancer as like a perfect storm. Literally like a hurricane, we've had quite a few this year, but in general, certain multiple things and factors have to align in order to get, potentially a hurricane and or similarly breast cancer. So I don't want women to hear what I'm about to say and say, oh my God, I've got three of those risk factors. I'm going to get breast cancer. Not at all. But it's important to understand what those risks are and, most importantly, what we can do about them. So as far as risk factors, certainly estrogen and estrogen exposure in a woman's lifetime looks like it's one of the pieces of the puzzle. And what I'm getting at is for example, women, young girls who start their periods very early, 8, 9, 10 years old, women who have menopause late, well into their 50s, what that entails in a woman's body is a lot of estrogen and you know, potentially other, you know, hormones that, mm-hmm. while they may not cause breast cancer, can sometimes stimulate or perpetuate, or as I often describe, add fuel to the fire. So, so in a nutshell, young girls who start their periods early, women who have menopause later in life, oftentimes women will ask about breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is wonderful for both mom and baby. No solid literature one way or another whether breastfeeding is protective, but what we do know is that pregnancy before the age of 30 is helpful. And women who either have pregnancy after the age of 30 or no children, for example, people have done populations in, you know, the nun population, that they're at increased risk potentially for breast cancer. But again, it's really important to temporize what I'm saying. It's not that, gosh, you haven't had any children or you had your first baby at 35 and sure. so, you know, gosh, we're on the road to breast cancer. Not at all. Not at all. And then, of course, certainly family history. And, you know, we were just saying 4 out of 5 women don't have any family history. But it's important in the population that does that we look at who had breast cancer and at what age potentially. And it may even open up the door to potentially genetic counseling and testing, which, again, we do at St. Francis as well as, you know, throughout the state of Connecticut, women can ask their providers. Mm-hmm. And what that entails is really understanding who in the family, and I would stress that dad's side is just as important as mom's side. Oftentimes people will focus on mom's side, but dad's side is equally important. Although sometimes in dad's side it's harder to trace because you may not have mom and 3 aunts and a grandma. You may just have 1 aunt, maybe grandma, mm-hmm. maybe dad's side of the family didn't have a lot of women. Mm-hmm. When it comes to looking at family history, we want to look at both sides. We want to know, you know, age at diagnosis. And certainly if there is, you know, multiple relatives, you know, 1, 2 or greater in particular with breast cancer, especially if it was premenopausal, but even if it wasn't, it is a very good starting point to have a conversation with the genetic counselors.
Very good. Dr.
Just
Reska,
briefly.
Oh, yeah. I did want to touch upon hormone replacement therapy. We've got about a minute and a half, and then we can remind folks about the upcoming event that you guys
sure.
are hosting.
Yeah, hormone replacement therapy often gets a very bad rap among our world of breast surgeons, although I know in the GYN world it can be very helpful to a lot of women. And if we look at the literature and the data, certainly prolonged hormone replacement use can certainly, as I said earlier, add fuel to the fire. Is it causing breast cancer? Well, we know it's far more complex than that. But certainly if there are abnormal cells or precancerous cells or even cancerous cells, estrogen can certainly be fueling that. And so in a woman who's had breast cancer before, particularly an estrogen-fueled cancer, and that's one of the things that we always test for when trying to discern what type of breast cancer we're dealing with, we would not want her on any type of hormone replacement. For the average woman, especially if she's going through very debilitating menopausal symptoms, a short course of estrogen, particularly if quality of life is severely affected, is not unreasonable. But there has to be a goal and an end point. You don't want to be just taking hormone replacement indefinitely. So, you know, 3 to 5 years is usually the range that we feel comfortable with. But certainly prolonged, extended use of hormone replacement therapy, that's I think, where we start to have a little bit more concern.
Excellent. And bringing it back around to the top with Dr. Christine Risk, we've got this incredible event coming up that gives any woman no excuse for a screening mammogram. Pink Link is happening on Wednesday, October 18th from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. for the underinsured and uninsured women at 3 locations: at Radiology Associates of Hartford on Sycamore Street in Glastonbury, at Comprehensive Women's Health Center on at St. Francis on Woodland Street in Hartford, and at the Johnson Surgery Center's Radiology Department on Hazard Avenue in Enfield. If you need to make an appointment, you can call 860-969-6400. A physician order is required prior to your appointment. And if you'd like to get more information, you can go to rahxray.com/pinklink to find out more. I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Christine Risk, who is the medical director for the Comprehensive Women's Health Center at St. Francis. She'll be among the many professionals who will be working hard, not only on Wednesday, October 18th, during the Pink Link 12-hour screening event, but 365 days a year around to help folks understand and diagnose or rule out breast cancer. And she has been a fantastic resource for the program this morning. Thank you so much, Dr. Risk, and I'm sure we'll be back to talk to more of your associates before we get to the end of 2017's Breast Cancer Awareness Month here in October. All right. Well, maybe you've heard about acupuncture. Maybe you've had it been through the process of treatment using acupuncture, if you haven't, or even if you have, maybe there's something for you to learn today. We're so pleased to be here at Connecticut Family Acupuncture as a guest of Matt Manasia, and from forever forward, Matt will be known as the man with the golden Mac here as we sit at his desk. As Connecticut continues to deal with the opioid crisis, on a more serious note, one local practice here is offering a natural solution to avoid addiction in the first place. Here at Connecticut Family Acupuncture, they're on a mission to educate people about this proven pain relief method. And Matt is here, and I am his guest today. He's founder of Connecticut Family Acupuncture, and we're going to take the balance of the program to explain how the treatment works for a variety of conditions. So, Matt, tell me about the process leading up to finding your own practice here.
Well, thanks, John. I opened it with my wife, Jill, who I met in acupuncture school in Texas. We're both from Connecticut, and we moved back to start our practice here. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary in August. Thank you. We have offices in West Hartford, obviously, where we're at, mm-hmm. Bolton, and we're planning to open more locations throughout the state.
So for folks that may have seen it, heard it described to them, you know, saw it on some television program or read about it in a magazine, can you expand a little bit on what acupuncture really is?
Sure. Well, first of all, you want to make sure that you're getting acupuncture from a licensed acupuncturist in Connecticut. It's a soapbox I won't get on here, but there's a number of other medical professions in the state that can legally do acupuncture with no training. So just make sure that the title of your provider is a licensed acupuncturist. And
so they make every plumber actually have a certification, but you don't have to do it to do acupuncture.
Well, you do. Well, sort of. In order,
plumber has to have a license, but
right. The people who go as a licensed acupuncturist, you have to have gone to a 3 to 4 year postgraduate school, where you learn basically just acupuncture. So, anyways,
it's a dedicated profession.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, acupuncture is great for so many things. It really excels at treating pain, chronic pain, you know, headaches, you know, intestinal pain, reproductive pain in women. So yeah, that's what it treats. Basically it's pretty simple. It's not quite as mysterious as a lot of people make it out to be. We put the little needles in your skin, basically, and your body kind of, you know, has this overreaction and pumps out a lot of endorphins, which get into the bloodstream and they bind to the pain receptors. So they kind of dull the pain that way. But your body also produces a lot of anti-inflammatory stuff, which gets into the areas that we need it to get to, because acupuncture also is great at opening up blood flow.
I see.
Yeah.
Maybe the mystique comes from the fact that in my brief research on it and connection to it over the years,
doesn't it, as a therapeutic practice, almost precede written history?
Yeah. In fact, we don't know how old it really is. You know, there's some estimates that date it to about 10,000 years old. But, you know, most commonly accepted about 3,000 years old. There's even, you know, they find these guys in the ice, right? Like, they found this guy was in Austria in a glacier. He was, I think they dated him about 10,000 years old, and he actually had small tattoos on certain acupuncture points. They did an autopsy on him and found that he had these particular illnesses that would have corresponded to those points. We would have used those points to treat him for those. So who knows? You know.
Yeah, I'm also seeing here in the notations that a couple of other potentially beneficial chemicals are produced through acupuncture. Dopamine and serotonin are those pain relief or anti-inflammatory or other?
All of the above. They're neurotransmitters, so they're really involved in your stress response, just in your overall mood, in your sleep cycles, even in digestion. So basically acupuncture kind of helps regulate those. So it's excellent for anxiety, for insomnia. That's one of the big things we treat here, is kind of, you know, anxiety, depression, stress-related disorders like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a lot of patients or clients who come to you who are fearful because their exposure to this has been pictures of people that literally look like a porcupine when they're on the table?
Yeah, that or the bed of nails thing. Yeah, people, I mean, you know, they are needles, but they're extremely thin. They're hair thin. Mm-hmm. You can fit about 8 of the needles we use in the hole of a hypodermic needle. Ooh. Yeah, and they're solid, so they're not kind of tearing into you like a hypodermic needle either. They're just kind of pushing the tissue aside. I myself am a huge needle wimp, you know, like blood tests. Are not my thing, and but I can have acupuncture done all day. Yeah, and you know, once people experience what it feels like, it's super relaxing. People fall asleep on the acupuncture table all the time. So,
and these come out of sterile packaging. They're one time use, and it's not like they go into an autoclave or something.
Exactly. Yeah. In the U.S., it's regulated by the FDA, approved as a medical device, but they have to be, you know, individually packaged, sterile, and disposable.
So there is virtually no pain, but there is there are various sensations attached to depending on where the needles are applied.
Yep, exactly. Basically, it can be anything. You can almost feel like a pressure, just like somebody pressing you with a finger. Sometimes it's a little tingly. Sometimes it's a slight kind of warm sensation. And then sometimes as you're lying there during the treatment, you know, you might even feel kind of like this little movement along your arm or leg. That's along these acupuncture pathways. Sometimes you feel like you have a needle where you don't, you know? So I'll come back after a session and somebody will say like, man, the only one I felt was, you know, on my elbow, and there's no needle on their elbow. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, since every body reacts in a slightly different way to any kind of treatment, do you ever get patients where you'll do applications and they'll actually say they're sort of like feeling some sort of a rush? Activation of bodily chemicals is stimulated?
Yeah, everybody reacts differently, but very commonly people will feel really heavy during the treatment, not in any kind of, you know, unsettling way, just a real nice, comfortable sensation.
Like similar to hypnotherapy?
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes people feel real energized during or after. A lot of times people will say that, you know, they're feeling a lot in one particular area of the body, like, you know, one leg or, you know. But, you know, it's typically not anything that's you know, overwhelming, whatever sensation people feel. And almost everybody walks out of here with a big smile on their face. Yeah.
Is it also true that you know, if somebody comes in with an issue with their ankle, the needles may not go in the ankle?
Yes, there's a number of different approaches. It's kind of, acupuncture's kind of evolved in different directions over those thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of different approaches. So in some cases, yeah, for ankle pain, I might just be doing points on somebody's wrist. In order to actually, basically the idea is it's kind of tricking the brain to, like I mentioned before, like have this anti-inflammatory response in the ankle. Sometimes we do points in the area of the pain. It depends on a few different factors. And sometimes, you know, when we do the points in the ankle, say, you know, we might actually hook up a little electricity to that. So it kind of, you know, makes the needles vibrate and, it just increases that blood flow.
Very interesting. Well, as we indicated earlier in the introduction, we're also here to reinforce the fact that acupuncture can also be used as a pain relief alternative to opioids. We're going to come back and talk to Matt more specifically about that after a quick break. If you just joined us, we're with Matt Menezia, owner of Connecticut Family Acupuncture, one decade strong here in West Hartford and in Bolton, and soon perhaps in a community closer to you, but very easy to locate, as I have found coming in from Western Connecticut. We'll be back to talk to Matt here at Connecticut Family Acupuncture. Stand by and stick with us. Thanks.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Animal Haven's 23rd annual Walk-A-Dog-A-Thon will take place on Sunday, October 22nd on the North Haven Town Green from 1 to 3:30 p.m. Walkers can sign up now online or by mail. Event activities include a one-mile dog walk, vendor booths, raffle prizes, a pet parade, and costume contest with plenty of treats and fun for all members of the family. The Animal Haven is a nonprofit charitable organization serving the greater New Haven area since 1948. It's a no-kill shelter whose mission is to provide a temporary, safe, caring, and humane refuge for the homeless, adoptable cats and dogs in the area. If you'd like to donate or contribute raffle items or just get a registration packet, you can call 203-249-7355 or click on theanimalhaven.com.
We're back with Matt Menezia. He's owner of Connecticut Family Acupuncture. And as we kind of got a crash course in what acupuncture is all about and how it feels and what it can do, one of the things that we've been able to at least get oriented to is that acupuncture is proven pain relief, which means that people may be interested in looking at it more intently now that we are in the midst of this opioid epidemic here as a possible alternative. So first of all, Matt, if I understand correctly, acupuncture has been playing a pretty important role in the world of detox for quite a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. There's at least in the U.S. and the U.K., there's around 1,000 addiction treatment facilities, including hospitals, that use this particular protocol of 5 acupuncture points on the ear. It was developed by an organization called the National Acupuncture Detoxification Association. So this can be taught to pretty much anybody. And what that does is that, you know, these particular points really stimulate this release of endorphins, which kind of cushion the blow from someone who's an active user to, you know, to being clean and sober, because you're getting your body's own natural opioids into the bloodstream. So those receptors aren't screaming out so much for the synthetic opioid. And works really well.
I was going to say, if people think that this is something that is unique or is not prolific, there's hundreds of hospitals right here in the United States that actually have acupuncture specialists on board in the operating room? or something like that?
Not so much the operating room, although we are seeing it more and more in emergency rooms, actually. One of my colleagues from acupuncture school is kind of a pioneer in that in the Milwaukee area. But no, as far as I know, every hospital in the state of Connecticut has at least one acupuncturist on staff. Mm-hmm. They're mostly used in oncology because acupuncture is so wonderful for treating the side effects of chemotherapy and radiation, and, you know, can help with the, you know, any type of pain that comes up, nausea, and just, you know, overall stress relief.
And in terms of the substitute for opioids, it basically just stimulates the body to produce the same chemicals that impact the nervous system as the opioid.
That's part of it, a big part of it. But, I mean, acupuncture, you know, treats singularly a lot of the symptoms or the side effects of withdrawal, like insomnia, agitation, even muscle aches and digestive issues. So, you know, we have people coming in for just those symptoms, you mm-hmm. know, without the addiction. So, yeah, it's a kind of a, there's two real ways that it helps with people getting off. Mm. Yeah.
Are there, as we talked about earlier, everybody's an individual physiological case. Are there a segment of the population who it just doesn't work for or can't work for?
Good question. We don't see too many folks like that. A lot of people ask if they need to believe in it for it to work. Certainly not. A lot of like the biggest skeptics coming in here turn into our best patients. Mm. And, you know, it's actually becoming real popular in the veterinary world. So, yeah, a lot of dogs and cats are getting it. And, you know, I say I actually get referrals from a lot of people's pets because they bring their pet for acupuncture, see how well it works for them, and then they decide, oh, okay, I'll try it and come in. Uh-huh. The only people that I find it doesn't work for are people who kind of actively don't want it to work for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were dragged in by their spouse and, you know, don't want to be here in the first place.
Right.
But
so there is a component of willfulness that acts in concert with the actual therapy that will help. In other words, if somebody's who really believes in it and wants to kind of holistically make the effort to get off of opioids or stop using alcohol, that's your best customer, basically.
Certainly for addiction. Yeah. I mean, the you know, acupuncture is not going to be a magic bullet. We're really going to need somebody to be committed. But, you know, if they follow our treatment plan, they'll have a much better chance. But in terms of it working for other issues, no, I mean, it's not necessarily that, you know, you have to really want it to work or you know, kind of have that placebo mm-hmm. effect going on. I think it's more those people who it doesn't work for, probably no type of medicine is really going to work for, okay. You know?
Right. Yeah. And as you said earlier, almost if not every hospital in the state of Connecticut has an acupuncturist. So obviously it is a therapy that is globally and widely embraced by the medical profession. But what about insurance companies?
Yeah, well, we're getting there with the medical profession. Certainly in the 10 years I've been in practice, we've come a long way. Insurance companies are a little slower to embrace acupuncture. There's some insurers in the state who cover it. Currently, the coverage is pretty limited. You know, for instance, somebody may come in with back pain, but their insurance will only cover it acupuncture for knee pain. The acupuncture community in the U.S. is always, you know, looking to talk to state legislators and work on getting people more access to acupuncture coverage. Mm-hmm. And even recently, the Attorney General, George Jepson, signed on to a letter with 36, I believe, other states' attorneys general. The letter was to the president and CEO of America's Health Insurance Networks, mm-hmm. I believe is the name of the organization. And the letter, the intent of the letter was requesting that insurance companies encourage their providers and incentivize them to, you know, send people to more natural therapies like acupuncture and chiropractic and physical therapy before prescribing any opioid medication. So I think that's a step in the right direction, and you know, we'll keep pushing for it.
Before we go, I also see that, you know, as you said, it works well for chronic pain, anxiety, women's health issues, headaches, but also for things like both fibromyalgia and allergies. Can you give an example of someone, say, with or could it be applied to someone, say, with a pet allergy, where you know, they've come into a relationship with somebody who's a cat owner, and they want to have a life together with the cat, and the half of the couple is allergic to cats. Are you the person to see for that?
That, I'll be honest, we don't have as much luck with that as we do with seasonal allergies. But we have definitely had people who we've been able to help with that. A lot of times with something like that, where you're in contact with the allergen constantly, we have certain Chinese herbal formulas that work well for that. And we have some certain dietary recommendations that can really make a big difference too.
So part of your practice here is not just they come in, they get the needles, they go out. You have some in-concert therapies that can either act as a component to the treatment, or do you work with other professionals, you know, in collaboration with your patients as referral?
Yeah, we absolutely work in collaboration with a whole variety of different medical professionals. Here, we also do Chinese herbal medicine, which is, you know, really in China, you know, they go hand in hand. You know, I mean, there's acupuncture and there's herbal medicine. What we find here is, you know, many of our patients respond very well to the acupuncture alone. So generally, we're going to try that out first. And if, you know, within a few treatments, we're not getting to the point we think we should be at, we'll add in some Chinese herb formulas.
Great. Very good. Well, if folks have heard enough so that they may want to meet you or learn more, let them know where they can go to find out more about you, Matt.
Yeah, certainly. Our website has a lot of information on there, and that is www.ctfamilyacupuncture.com.
Very good. 10 years strong here in Connecticut, recently celebrating their 10th anniversary here in West Hartford and Bolton, and soon other locations in the state. Matt Menezia is owner of Connecticut Family Acupuncture, a great crash course on not only the science and physiology behind it, but also great information about how acupuncture can help relieve pain, especially in relation to folks who may be wanting to not take opioids, but also in relation to people that may be engaged in an opioid addiction or even an alcohol addiction. Learned a lot, Matt. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Well, we may be getting into cold weather, but depending on how the climate situation runs during the winter time, ticks and tick-borne diseases can be an issue literally 12 months a year, depending on temperatures and conditions. And I was somewhat concerned to receive notice a couple of weeks ago that Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, DEEP, and the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station report that a heavy population of Lone Star ticks has been detected at the Manresa Island, formerly the Norwalk Harbor Station in South Norwalk, Connecticut, marking the first known established reproducing population here in the state of Connecticut. So when the subject of ticks and tick-borne diseases come up, I know that the people I reach out to as a health journalist turn to my guest who's on the line with us this morning, Kirby Stafford. Dr. Stafford is a medical veterinary entomologist whose research focuses on the ecology and control of the black-legged tick that transmits the agents of Lyme disease, human babesiosis, and human ehrlichiosis. He also has expertise in biological control of fly pests of livestock and poultry pest management. Dr. Stafford, thank you for joining us here on the show this morning.
Oh, you're welcome.
So, first of all, let us utilize this opportunity as a reminder to people that the chilling temperatures are no reason to forget about the risk of tick-borne disease.
Yeah, I think the critical story is that people shouldn't lose focus of our black-legged tick, or deer tick, as a lot of people know it. That tick is our primary tick that people are going to continue to encounter. And Lyme disease is going to continue to be the major disease that people have a risk of acquiring. And here with the fall, we're actually entering the season for adult black-legged tick activity, and so people are still will be at risk here through the fall, warm days in the winter, because the adult stage of the tick does not hibernate,
right.
And then through the spring, although most Lyme disease cases do occur in the summer months from the smaller nymphal stage of the tick.
Mm-hmm. Does the nymph have even though it's physically smaller, does it also have the potential to either be more aggressive to attacking a blood source, or more potent in its capacity to pass on to a human source these tick-borne diseases?
Well, there's no difference between the nymph and adult in terms of the ability to transmit the Lyme pathogen and other diseases associated with the tick. Infection rates do tend to be just slightly higher in the adults. But the real risk is because the nymphs are smaller, hard to detect, and being active during the summer, that's because when people are outdoors and have a greater degree of exposure.
Mm-hmm. But here in the fall and even into the wintertime, folks that may be hiking in tall grass or wooded areas, certainly folks who may be out in the wood pile splitting wood, or out in the yard doing fall or early winter landscaping cleanup, those ticks can get onto their clothes and work their way to the skin surface, right?
Oh, correct. I mean, you're still at risk of picking up a tick and getting Lyme disease or babesiosis or anaplasmosis, or, you know, here through the, fall, and like I said, even winter or spring months.
Mm-hmm. They are crafty insects that are pretty tenacious when it comes to finding a source of food.
Oh, definitely. Now, the adults do prefer larger animal. Deer is the main host for the adult stage of the tick.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, we had a mild winter last winter, and our tick testing laboratory, which is overseen by Dr. Gudars Malay, was just inundated with adult ticks, even through the winter months, when usually we see, a lot less activity because it's just simply too cold or the ticks are buried underneath the snow.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that brings up another question as people ask, well, it was a really bad winter. We had a lot of snow. Is that going to impact the ticks? Yes, it is. They do quite well underneath the snow. Snow is an insulator, so tick survival is actually probably higher when you have a lot of snow cover.
Mm-hmm. Well, turning our attention to South Norwalk, if I'm reading into the background information correctly, mainland residents don't necessarily need to kind of, you know, put up barriers and be extremely concerned that they're going to be inundated with Lone Star ticks to accompany their black-legged and deer tick friends into the near future. But nonetheless, I'm sure from a scientist's perspective, as much as some of the imaging that came from the island, particularly the deer carcass, were very, very hard to look at and digest the information. Tell us a little bit about that journey and getting the call to come and take a look.
Well, to give a little bit of background, the Lone Star tick is the primary tick biting humans in the southeastern United States. About 95% of all the tick bites occurring in the southeast are by the Lone Star tick. This tick has been slowly moving north. It started moving on to the eastern end of Long Island back in the early 1990s, and this tick has become extremely abundant on parts, particularly the eastern parts of Long Island, and since then. In fact, people are starting to be bitten more frequently by Lone Star ticks than black-legged ticks on parts of Long Island as its population has increased. So it's something we've been watching. We've been seeing about 70 to 90-ish so Lone Star ticks being submitted by residents of Connecticut, mainly in Fairfield County, to our tick testing laboratory. Mm-hmm. Dr. Millay has been noticing a uptick, pardon the tongue pun,
sure,
in the number of Lone Star ticks being submitted, but we just generally did not pick them up in our sampling or our research programs. So that meant that these ticks are carried. You can get them occasionally in Maine, northern New England, Canada, as they're carried north by migrating birds. But those are isolated tick individuals. So people do get bitten by this tick.
Mm-hmm.
But the tick wasn't, unlike Long Island right now, was not established with a reproducing population. And so this was the first locality that I became aware of where we actually had a small focus of the tick reproducing, and listening to people, it appears that tick may have also been present for some time on Sheffield Island, which is just right off the coast there, which wouldn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
So certain people, the risk is still low. It's only 2-3% of the ticks that are submitted here to the experiment station. But we are seeing an increase in the number of Lone Star tick bites down in southwestern Connecticut. Still way overmatched by the number of black-legged ticks that people get bitten by.
Mm-hmm.
It's something to watch, and it certainly will increase the possible spectrum of diseases that physicians should be on the lookout for in their patients after a tick bite.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much interaction or wherewithal do you have to pipeline this sort of more... from 10,000 feet, kind of breaking news or new information about the possibility to the medical industry and healthcare providers here, especially in southwestern Connecticut, be on the lookout now for this kind of new range of symptoms that may come from a Lone Star tick bite?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that was one of the purposes of putting out the press release, was just help increase awareness.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be Ehrlichiosis is the primary disease associated with the Lone Star tick. It's the symptoms and treatment is the same as the anaplasmosis that is transmitted by our black-legged tick. So from a clinical standpoint, there isn't a whole lot of difference,
mm-hmm.
From the physician and patient handling it. But it is a difference, in critical difference, in terms of which actual pathogen you're actually dealing with.
Are there any, in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Kirby, are there any specific warning signs or symptoms that people might look for that are unique to the Lone Star tick and the diseases that they carry?
Well, I mean, the diseases that they carry, like I said, it's very similar to anaplasmosis. So we have a lot of literature out on and there's a new little guide flyer that we have available on our website as well that, you know, talks about the symptoms of anaplasmosis, and they'll be very similar to what you'll see in ehrlichiosis as well. Another condition that people have asked about, you know, associated with the Lone Star tick is the alpha-gal syndrome. It's a red meat or a red meat allergy. There's just not very much in the way of statistics available in terms of how many people get that. It's an allergic reaction that develops to red meat after being bitten by a Lone Star tick in some individuals. And it's starting to see quite an increase in the number of cases of that on Long Island, where the Lone Star tick has been present for quite a while. So, but we don't really, it's not reportable, so we don't really have any good idea of what proportion of people actually will get it after being bitten by a Lone Star tick. Not everyone does, and what the true incidence is.
Sort of ironic that one of the national, the leading national markets for red meat to the meat-eating public is Texas, and the Lone Star tick is takes its name from that state. Sadly ironic, I guess. But in closing, if folks want to learn more, they can just go to ct.gov/CAES and begin to explore information on tick-borne illnesses and other and other details that you have on the site.
That is correct. And the CDC also has a great deal of very useful information available on the ticks and tick-borne diseases as well.
Excellent. Dr. Kirby Stafford is a medical veterinary entomologist whose research focuses on the ecology and control of the deer tick or black-legged tick that transmits the agents of Lyme disease, human babesiosis, and ehrlichiosis. He has been kind enough to come on the program to talk about the recent discovery of the reoccurring population of Lone Star ticks down in South Norwalk at the former Norwalk Harbor Station and other locations in that area. Great to speak with you, Kirby, and thank you so much for your continued work on behalf of all the folks in Connecticut who face the potential exposure to tick-borne disease here in the state. Doing great work, and I appreciate your information this morning.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.